This afternoon we have the session which is defending the argument that time is fundamental. You know who the speakers are. It's the opposite of the argument that was made this morning. I also wanted to say that we are really, really happy how everyone is participating and discussing a lot. So it's beyond our expectations how this is going. However, I'm not sure if everyone that's attending the conference has spoken already, has intervened. And so for the rules of finger, hand, I'm going to add one more rule this afternoon, which is if you haven't spoken and intervened yet, you can raise this like this. And that will be given priority at all times. So please, if you haven't spoken, remember we brought you all here because we want to hear your ideas and speak up your mind. And after this, I'm going to introduce Lee.
Well, very good. I'm terrified because the last session spoke about issues and approaches that I have had a lot to do with. And that, although I still follow and still contribute to it from time to time, I grew skeptical whether they could fully succeed. And I'll be indicating in a little bit why that was. But I'm very aware of the fragility of new research programs and new ideas. The research programs that we were hearing about were once fragile and little baby research programs. And now they've grown up to be big and tough, and they have a good body of results to defend. What I'm going to talk about is an initiation of a new research program. And I'm well aware that to some of you it will look fragile and silly, but for reasons I'll be discussing, I think it's absolutely necessary. This came up a little bit before. I think when we mean cosmology, when I mean cosmology, I don't mean large-scale astronomy. I mean the description using theoretical physics of the universe as a whole. And I think that therefore we seek a different kind of theory and possibly different kinds of explanations than our conventional and theoretical physics. What I'm about to give is an argument strongly to that effect, followed by an argument that the different kind of theory will necessarily treat time very differently than we have treated time up till now in theoretical physics. So we seek a cosmological theory, by which we mean a theory which first applies to a single causally closed system which has no copies and is not a member of any ensemble. The universe as a whole is unique in the sense that there's one of them. It happens once. It is, to quote my collaborator Roberto, it is what it is and has the history it has. It may have had many different histories and many different states that it doesn't have and never will. We're dealing with something that happens once and incorporates everything in the universe. The universe, by definition, should allow in our description and need no external clocks, external reference frames, external measuring apparatuses, external observers. It contains any of those that exist. There is a big problem in fundamental particle physics of the following form. We have the best theory, as Sean has written, and he calls it the core theory, ever achieved in physics of the fundamental particles. It's beautiful, it's deeply successful. It also looks extraordinarily arbitrary. It looks like a large number of arbitrary choices were made in its construction. These include the tunings of about 29 three-dimensionless parameters. I think a cosmological theory must explain how the law, let me back up, to the extent that we can understand the question, we have good evidence that a lot of similar theories might be in the place of the standard model, with different gauge groups, different representations of fermions and scalars, different values of the parameters. So we know a big set of theories that are equally mathematically consistent and equally physically meaningful as effective field theories for elementary particle physics. Why do we see the one that we see? I think a cosmological theory has to address that, and it also has to address the issues of the initial conditions that have been already much discussed the last 2 days. Without the need of something that seems artificial, like a past hypothesis, and without having to get into the funny business which was discussed of saying that the one universe that exists is highly improbable. This, I believe, cannot be, and I'm going to explain precisely why, cannot be classical mechanics or quantum mechanics just scaled up. But it has to reproduce the physics we know, that is the standard model plus general relativity, on smaller scales than the universe as a whole when applied to subsystems. And I also, a part of that is it has to resolve the measurement problem, which is the key unresolved issue in our understanding of quantum mechanics. So that may seem ambitious, but what the hell? What else do we have to do? Now, this is a formal methodological argument of a kind that we're not used to making as theoretical physicists. So I hope you'll take the time and think about it and see its strength. This is an argument that it can't just be any of the theories that we know about scaled up. Our claim is that all the current theories we know about, general relativity, classical mechanics, quantum field theory, only make sense, that is, only have an operational interpretation that can connect them to experiment, which is, after all, what it means to be a theory of physics, in the case that they apply to small subsystems of the universe. One reason is the freedom to choose the initial conditions, which is an intrinsic part of those theories, and the clean separation between the choice of the laws and the choice of the initial conditions. Why do we have this choice? We have this choice because it mirrors the freedom of the experimentalist to do an experiment over and over again, changing at will the initial conditions in order to test hypotheses as to what the general laws are. And this separation of laws and initial conditions requires that the experiment be able to be done over and over again, which means that you're dealing with the study of a subsystem of the universe. Because of this clean separation between laws and initial conditions, the formal structure of all these theories is as follows. There's a state space, which is timeless, which is just set out. X is the state space of the theory. That's the kinematics. That gives the possible states of affairs that the theory can describe. And on that state space, there's a vector field or a flow, which is the Hamiltonian, which is the dynamics. And that also is timeless and given once and for all, representing the belief that the laws of physics don't change, that once given, they are what they are. And we describe theories with these two features of fixed configuration or state spaces and fixed sets of laws acting on them as satisfying the Newtonian paradigm. And you might ask, what else could there be? How else could we do science? And I think that Stuart was telling us yesterday, and Barbara a little bit, and George a little bit, but Stuart very explicitly, how to do science in the absence of those conditions. So it's not necessary. We do it for a reason, and we do it for a reason because we study subsystems, small, tiny subsystems of a larger universe where it makes sense to repeat experiments over and over again. These states can be distinguished by the values of the observables, and the observables are not arbitrary. They correspond to what we, external to the system, can do to it. We can translate it, we can excite it, we can apply currents to it and so forth. And these all are why the observable algebra is what it is. I'm going to take 15, so is that? Let me get through enough of the argument.
A total of 15, okay. Yeah. 15 more.
Yes, sure. Fine. So that is the nature of theories. Let's go ahead. That is the nature of theories that we work with. I believe essentially all my good friends and colleagues who were just debating in the last session were all basing their ideas on a mistake. And the mistake is to take this methodological structure of these theories which have been developed to deal with parts of the universe and apply them to the whole universe. And that we call the first cosmological fallacy. If you buy this argument, and this is an argument which is very compacted, and I'm not going to, unless you ask me, I'm not going to go further into details, you conclude that we need a new methodology, a new structure to do physics that could address the cosmological issues. Indeed, a lot goes wrong when we make the fallacy and just try to scale up the theories that we have to answer cosmological questions. The operational context for infinite sets of initial conditions breaks down. One can no longer distinguish hypotheses about laws from hypotheses about initial conditions. There are degeneracies, as cosmologists call it. The notion of a general law doesn't win anything, apply to a unique system, and we cannot address the questions of what were the laws and what were the initial conditions. I'm going to skip that. There are consequences of this search for a new paradigm for the nature of time, which is why we're here, and I'll state these and I'll be done. And again, I'm stating what are the conclusions of long arguments that are discussed in our books and papers. In the Newtonian paradigm, time is inessential or weak because the value of any observable at any time can be transformed if you can invert the equations of motion to the value of, to a function of the initial conditions. Time can be integrated away. Because there is a complete mathematical model of the system, evolution in time, causal evolution in time, is equivalent to logical implication in the mathematical model. So the essence of time, that is causal development, is mapped to something which is timeless, logical implication. And because of the state spaces are timeless, there's no occasion for novelty. A novelty would be an occasion when a system with new properties that could not have existed before comes to exist in the world. In a cosmological theory, we argue that time may be, and indeed must be, strong in the following senses. That time, in the sense of causation and change, precedes laws. Time is more fundamental. Causation and change is more fundamental than laws. Laws can and do change and evolve in a prior time. As Roberto likes to say, change changes. The state space may also change. And both of these changes may occur in ways which are not entailed by the past. There can be no precise mathematical model of this kind of universe. That is, time being strong means that there is no timeless copy which is a precise mirror of the universe, because were there such a copy, the universe would not be unique. There would be a copy which had a mirror of all its properties. Hence, novelty is possible. We argue, and I don't give the argument, but it was first given by Peirce in 1892, that to explain the selection of laws in a way that implies testable consequences requires that the laws evolve. And there's an argument I'm not giving, but I'm just giving the milestones of the conclusions. Does this lead to a dilemma? If you say that the laws evolve, are you positing a meta-law, and you then have an endless regress because then you have to say why this meta-law and not other meta-laws? There's a lot to say about that. The short answer is not necessarily if the meta-laws do not fit the structure of the Newtonian paradigm. That is, there's not a timeless state space of meta-laws and a timeless dynamical principle. This argument then leads to a research program to make good on the whole story. And the key point is to answer the meta-law dilemma by giving examples of hypotheses about how the laws might have evolved, which is free of the meta-law dilemma, and which leads to empirical consequences. And we've given several over the years: cosmological natural selection, the principle of precedence, energetic causal sets, which we developed with Marina, and what I'm calling, but you can ask me what I mean by it, anti-deterministic evolution. Hence, there exist non-Newtonian theories which address the need for a cosmological theory. That is, this is a real scientific research program. Those examples have implications, some of which are precisely stated predictions by which they could be tested and falsified. So this is an opportunity to break out of the back and forth and back and forth, if I may, over puzzles that arise by making the cosmological fallacy and just trying to answer cosmological questions by scaling up theories that are only sensible as theories of small subsystems, and start to do a scientific version of cosmology that may address the questions that I raised. This is highly ambitious. This is highly vulnerable to criticism. And I stop there.
Is your word to go now?
So initially, we had Roberto Mangabeira Unger to give also one of the provocations. We had to change the schedule because Roberto wasn't sure if we could come. We really asked him, and he agreed to still give 5 minutes, just a bit of an address after Lee's presentation, which are coming out of the Lee's period of questions, right?
Thank you. Just a different take on this intellectual program that Lee has outlined. His emphasis has been methodological. Mine will be substantive. And I propose to state it in a straightforward, natural, pre-scientific language, the better to make clear its intentions. Let me begin by saying what this program is not. It is not a defense of our experience, in particular our temporal experience, against science. It has never been hard to reconcile an influential scientific theory with our experience. For 200 years, a dominant influence on psychological and political theories was Newtonian mechanics, to the entire satisfaction of the contemporaries, imagining that social regimes and even constitutions could be conceived as mechanical devices designed by a Newtonian engineer. Let me give you an example. In our experience, the now has a special place. That's all we have right now. But for nature, the now enjoys no special status. If anything is real in nature, what is real is the process of transformation, which cannot be captured within the instantaneous moment. The only qualification to this refusal to defend experience is that we must not undermine experience so radically that the discoveries of science can no longer be translated into a language intelligible to us in the light of our experience. So first, the substantive program. The first proposition in the substantive program of this alternative is that there is no basic structure of the world and no permanent set of regularities, laws, symmetries, and constants exempt from change. Now that there is such an exemption is the central idea in the dominant tradition of physics from Galileo and Newton on, and indeed in the dominant tradition of Western thought since Aristotle. So this tradition affirms the reality of time only in a very qualified way, because it imagines that the basic structure of nature and its basic regularities are outside of time. We propose to deny that exemption in this program, and to imagine a world in which everything changes sooner or later, including the basic constituents and the fundamental regularities of nature. The second proposition in this substantive program is that for the reality of time to be radically affirmed, it cannot be that the universe has only a collection of local histories and no global or cosmic history. It must, in principle, be possible to place every event that has ever occurred in the history of the world on a single timeline. Now, whether it is indeed possible to do so depends on facts of the matter. It is not something that we can infer from a mathematical or metaphysical rationalization. For example, it may depend on whether the universe is so arranged that it supports the existence of a preferred state of rest or a class of fundamental observers who are situated in the world in a position that is relatively neutral with respect to certain criteria, such as the temperature at which the microwave radiation background strikes them, or the speed at which the galaxy is recedes from them. So this second proposition in the substantive agenda opens a horizon of empirical and experimental discovery. The third proposition in this substantive program is that the way in which nature presents itself to us in the cooled-down universe that we observe, with its discriminate structure and its relatively stable regularities, is not the only form that nature may take. In the very early universe, or in extreme situations later on in the history of the universe, this discriminate structure may be melted down, and the regularities from being stable become unstable. And even the distinction between laws and states of affairs may begin to collapse. It is a fundamental mistake, according to this point of view, to universalize our temporally provincial experience of nature, when everything in our discoveries about the universe of the history should advise us to do the opposite. Now, I want to complement this outline of the substantive program with a few methodological observations. The method is entirely subservient to the substance. The first methodological principle regards the relation between causes and laws. In this view, contrary to the dominant tradition in the history of modern Western thought, causation is a fundamental feature of nature, rather than a projection of the human mind. And we think that rather than our causal explanations being based on laws, the causal relations sometimes exhibit and sometimes do not recurrent law-like form. The second methodological principle has to do with the relation between history and structure. We think in this point of view that structure is derivative from history rather than the other way around. And that is the only way in which it can be in a historical science. The third methodological principle, has to do with the relation between the local and the global. Cosmology should not be practiced as scaled up local physics, but has to proceed on fundamentally different methods. And the fourth methodological attitude is a hostility to metaphysical and mathematical rationalism in natural science. The most important attribute of the universe is that it is what it is and not something else.
Okay, I'm going to take two questions from Enrique and Stu, and if you don't mind, we continue with João, and after that, oh, there's fists. Show me the fists. Oh, okay, Francesca. Okay, Enrique. Thank you.
Okay, so there is something I have difficulties to frame in what you said, and I think that my difficulty comes from a mismatch from your picture of what are the laws of nature and what I think, the way I think about the laws of nature in the contemporary way in which philosophy of science think of them, in the sense that laws of nature are not something that is given by God, it is not something we discover and they stay there forever, they are always provisional. So if the job of a scientist is to find those provisional laws, I don't see why this could be in contradiction with your program. And the other thing is that I have the impression that you're presenting your ideas as being revolutionary, and to me they sound very conservative. Because what we have learned from the history of science is the fact that we have been enlarging the world, this, what we call our universe, is getting larger and larger. So we were thinking that we were able to describe, whether you ask us to speak or not. So I have the impression that history of science is telling us that you come to new insights and you have revolutions in science when a law, so your provisional law of nature that you applied to the earth becomes also a law of nature that you can apply to understand the solar system, and then you can apply it to understand the galaxy, and then you understand. And of course, in this process, you have to give up something, so you to understand what is fundamental and what is not fundamental. And so I think here the game is to ask whether time is fundamental or not, and I don't see any reason why time should be fundamental. And
there's a lot there. If we haven't convinced you that there's at least a reason to think that time must be fundamental, then I've done a very bad job. Because I think if you think carefully, the structural methodological argument that I made shows, I could have made it in the other order. There's an argument that time is not fundamental. That's based on certain assumptions, which are based on a certain structure of theory. Those theories that satisfy those structures are only meaningful and can only give us science that is a description of experiments when applied to small subsystems of the universe. Therefore, those arguments fail when applied to the universe as a whole. Moreover, Peirce's argument, which I didn't give in any detail, establishes that if you want to have the ambition of understanding why the laws of physics are what they are, you have to invoke a notion of evolution of laws, of change of laws, that therefore precludes the move by which time emerges from timeless laws, as, for example, Carlos showed us one approach to. If laws evolve, then time cannot emerge from timeless law, so you can consider the opposite, which is that time is more fundamental. And I agree with you about the provisional and temporary, about the first part of what you say.
Okay, so please, if you can keep your questions for the panel discussion, we need to continue with João, the next speaker.
Okay, thank you very much for this invitation. So we were asked to be provocateurs by the organizers, which I guess means two tasks. First one is to be provocative, I guess, but we were also asked to listen, to be open-minded and listen to people and be ready to change. I'm afraid that with a couple of exceptions, I haven't seen much of that here. I think most people are just entrenching themselves in their work, their lines of research, and that's okay, but for a change, I'm actually going to stand up here and defend something I don't believe in. So everything I'm about to say, I don't believe in it. But you know, that's okay. First of all, I don't think belief should be part of this. It's not religion, this is science. So ultimately, without being Popperian or whatever, I hope that we can actually let experiment take the final word, and what I'm about to say certainly, we'll let experiment take the final word. And second, regardless of my beliefs or your research projects or whatever, what I'm about to say remains a distinct possibility, which will inform a lot this discussion about time, about whether time is fundamental or not, and connects that with something very important, which is where the universe came from. Okay? So the thing I'm about to envisage here, which is quite strong, is that there is not soft, not spontaneous, but hard breaking of just about everything, okay? What I mean here is really things like local Lorentz invariance, diffeomorphism invariance. Take your favorite symmetry and break it, and particularly for the purpose of this, this meeting, one thing I will question is time translational invariance, okay? And which this relates directly to what Lee said. You know, basically, the question is not so much whether there is time or there isn't time, it's a revolution in the laws of physics. And what happens to time and our perception of time if this is the case. So first of all, why don't I believe in it, just to contextualize this a little bit better. So this is obviously, so there is radical conservative or conservative radical, whatever. Well, this is radical radical, okay? And this is quite extreme, and I don't need to do this, but I will basically discuss this just to kind of to make things more concrete within the context of a varying speed of light. So very important, if you are very brutal about the way you consider a varying speed of light, well, A, things, horrible things may happen, like you can kill your grandmother before you were born and so on. We don't want that, okay? So we can be very brutal, but this actually happens. You don't need to. So that's a very important point here. There's other ways to do these, like biometric theories, and something called deformed special relativity that have a varying speed of light without actually breaking everything you can think of. But I'm going to break everything you can think of here. And I'm not saying I believe in it. And the reason is the following. I think we are cosmologists, some of us. There's a guy there who is a cosmologist. You're going to hate me for what I'm about to say. Don't look behind. And basically, we were told that we have to solve these two things, these kind of things called the cosmological problems. And a lot of this discussion here, in a way, is framed within this context. We have to solve cosmological problems. And I'd like to divide them into two types. There's Mark I, which is essentially what was proposed initially in the 80s. Things like the flatness problem, the entropy problem, the homogeneity problem, etc. That's really a bunch of fine-tuning issues with the Big Bang, which basically were behind discussion of things like inflation. Nowadays, I mean, there's what I call Mark II problems, which is the universe is not homogeneous. It has fluctuations, and we know them very carefully now. In fact, we know that their amplitude is on the order of 10 to the minus 5. The spectral index is 0.96, and numbers being added on every day, or every year, or every few years. So I'm going to argue here, before I continue, that these problems are problems invented and solved by people who've never done a day's work in their life, okay? I'm quoting from a British philosopher you might know at this point. Whereas I think this is a problem for the working classes, okay? And I regard myself as a working class cosmologist. So this is really what should be addressed, and in particular, Niyayashi is laughing because actually we have a way of doing this quite carefully, which is more predictive, more falsifiable, therefore, than inflation. And this is why I actually don't believe in what I'm about to say, which is be aristocratic for the rest of this talk, talk about these problems, and specifically talk about this particular approach. Okay, so radical, just for the sake of this conference. Okay, so having put things in context here, I'm going to be really, really quick. We were also asked to be quick and to the point. You were not. You're the worst one, actually. So I'm going to be very, very fast about what actually is assumed here. So how do you break all these things? Okay, first of all, if you ask about are there any frames in the universe, what kind of special frames in the universe are there, indeed, there is a special one. To quote from a Portuguese philosopher now, I suppose. So the special one here is the cosmological frame. There is actually a preferred frame in the universe. Okay? The cosmo frame. And sometimes people, you know, put up this smoke screen. Oh, that's not true, you know, blah, 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 because the universe is not exactly homogeneous. Well, to zeroth order it is, and earlier on there is. And once there is to zeroth order and earlier on, even the fluctuations, you can pick a gauge. So the smoke screen that in detail the cosmological frame doesn't exist, I think, is just misconceived. There is, as far as the universe is concerned, as far as the matter in the universe is concerned, there is indeed a preferred frame, and it's the cosmological frame, the frame where the universe looks on average homogeneous. Nowadays, you just have to look at the microwave background, not the galaxies. It's easier to look at the microwave background, and you have your preferred frame. Okay, so there is a preferred frame, so this is the first thing. I'm going to be pretty schematic and quick. Second point is that once there is a preferred frame, I think it would be perverse to think that this frame does not partake in the formulation of the laws of physics. So, perverse that it does not partake in the formulation of the laws. So I don't apologize. There's nothing deep here. I'm not being deep at all. But there are people who invoke the principle of beauty. So this is the principle of non-perversity, if you want. If there is a preferred frame, this doesn't need to be true, but it can be true. And there is some kind of logical thing. If the frame is there, why not use it to formulate the laws of physics as well? Now, this is testable, by the way, particularly because what you're saying is that the laws of physics only look the way they look in one frame. And if you shift yourself to another frame, they are different. Well, in fact, every 6 months, we're not in the preferred frame, and every 6 months, our speed changes. So you'd expect a change in the laws of physics every 6 months on Earth. So be very careful with these kind of things. If you play these games, you may contradict the experiment immediately. So the problem is once you avoid these pathologies, mea culpa, what actually happens is typically, you avoid the pathologies, you also put all the experimental consequences back in the beginning of the universe. So you're back to square zero, if you want. Hello, how are you? Okay, third point. Well, if this is true, then you can do the following. So once this is true, you can include explicit time variability in the laws of physics. So this is the point where you don't need to phrase this in terms of varying speed of light, but you can, if you want. And what you're saying is that my 4 is a very specific 3 plus 1. Okay, I have this foliation of space-time into leaves. And what I can do is write a Lagrangian, if I want, which is time-dependent, or a Hamiltonian, which is time-dependent. The easiest way to do this actually is to write the equations, the Einstein equations in this frame, and replace the C by a C of T, immediately you screw up everything, you bugger it all up, okay? You're guaranteed to do that. You have evolution in physics immediately. So this is essentially what I'm doing, okay? This is far from frivolous, so there's this question, meta law, do I have a meta law? Okay, there are laws evolving in time. Could this just be simply be encoded in a meta law? Well, the answer is no. This is far from frivolous because what you're saying is that time exists because the laws change. And what you're saying very concretely is that it's not only the case that the matter content of the universe is changing because of the cosmological expansion, but the Friedman equations are changing as well in time. The Lagrangian has a time dependence. So you're making a statement which is very concrete. There is time, and time is fundamental, because the laws of physics themselves change in time, and this immediately pegs down the existence of time and makes it fundamental. It's far from frivolous as well because of Noether's theorem. So remember that the symmetries of nature are associated with conserved quantities. If you violate any of these things, there is a conserved quantity which goes out of the window, disappears. And the time translational invariants of the laws are related to something which is nothing but energy conservation. So what you're saying is, well, then there is no energy conservation in the early universe if this is true. And so what? I want to create the universe at the Big Bang. Okay, the Big Bang, the matter in the universe has to come from somewhere. Well, violations of energy conservation, that's the obvious point, right? So don't be too shocked by the fact I'm not going to be producing matter or taking away matter now. But all this matter has to have come from somewhere. Okay, so in this way, we're actually plugging together the variability of the laws of physics with energy violations, energy conservation violations, and the fact that we're here, that the universe exists, appears. So very concretely, you can actually do this game. I won't do it in detail. Another thing we were asked is not provide details. But if you play the usual game of using the Bianchi identities to find conservation of energy, you find that you have a non-conservation. And this non-conservation has a lot of stuff, but contains the curvature of the universe times c dot over c. So if you have, for example, a closed universe, which therefore is supercritical, yeah, then this guy would be basically zero. So you solve the flatness problem. I was going to say I was going to be aristocratic for 20 minutes and solve these problems, which I don't think are problems. I don't think they're problems, but I know I can't solve them. You solve the flatness problem, but in addition, you actually link the existence of matter in the universe with this issue of time variability of constants, of laws, and therefore this issue of energy conservation. So let me just finish. I don't know if I have more time, but I'm just going to say one more thing. This is clearly very naive, but this is not meant to be serious. It's meant to just be provocative. It may be naive, but it's certainly better than a bloody scalar field with Einstein equations like inflation, okay? You will never learn anything about quantum gravity, about time, about the universe with something that simplistic. And I do think it's really bad that people, for example, in quantum gravity, realizing they can't solve the problems directly, try to plug their thing into inflation, which is clearly something designed to avoid contact with quantum gravity, okay? So I think this might be very naive, but it certainly is no less naive than inflation, and it at least encapsulates a bunch of issues which are very likely to be effectively things that come out of quantum gravity, namely the fact that the symmetries we see are really broken in the early universe. They're not things which are fundamental, but they are things which emerge approximately at late times. And I think that's all I have to say.
Trouble imagining what's meant by evolution of physical law, in the sense that I could imagine writing down some gigantic Lagrangian where all the coupling constants are either functions of time or some scalar or something, and then they all just basically turn on and off at different times. So at one time I have SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, but maybe in the past those constants turned off and something else turned on and so on. But it sounds to me like that's a bit trivial in an evolutionary sense. So I'm guessing you have something more fundamental in mind, but I'm having a bit of a hard time thinking what it is.
It's because you've been corrupted by the scalar field. Like,
well, maybe
else.
I've been corrupted, but
so I'm not
but
saying,
what can you give
I'm
an example
saying,
of what would right. be meant by an evolution of a law that is not simply the kind of thing I'm describing?
So if you take Brendstrup's theory, which replaces the gravitational constant by a scalar field, clearly we haven't violated anything. And the reason is exactly that your variability is within a meta law, is within a theory, which itself is a Lagrangian, which is time independent. So this is, in fact, the kind of games we play here. If you're a sensible person, or if you're a conservative radical or whatever, that's what you do. If you're not, if you take too many drugs or something like that, what you do is you put in by hand the C of T. And what happens is that you screw everything up. But you're trying to screw everything up to see what happens. So this is what's happening in this case. So you just go there literally to whatever this foliation, and you replace the C by the C of T, not because the scalar field dynamics gave you that, but because you're putting that in explicitly.
Well, that's, to me, that's not a whole lot different than what I just said. Yeah. So
it is. It is. And the first thing
how,
that actually
but
happens.
Else has a quest.
So the best technical way to see it is because immediately you lose energy conservation, which you don't in Brendstrup's theory, for example, which you don't in any theory in which a scalar field is driving, for example, a variation in alpha. So it is quite different.
So monkey around with conservation laws, basically. Would be
I agree.
All right. I'm not sure it would be in mind, but that's okay.
No one is asking to be radical.
I just don't see that it's all that radical to monkey with conservation laws. I think
not
that's
what
fairly
I mean
easy.
By evolution laws, but I'll come back. Sorry, I mean something very different by evolution.
For me, evolution of laws, means a Lagrangian which is time dependent, full stop. No, this is really boring, what he just said. Come on. Because, in fact, you can do that with a scalar field. And I've done that with John Barry, the scalar field. And you don't break anything.
What about you describing him describing a scalar field? So,
yeah, that's my point.
Every time you have a scalar field, you're boring. There's nothing you can do about it, OK?
But
learn the law.
But Brendstrup's theory is a scalar field.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's boring.
No, I'm saying Brendstrup's theory is not that. It's this.
It's boring, right? Because the scalar field is boring, and Brendstrup's theory is an extra scalar field.
I agree. Brendstrup's theory is boring.
Yeah, it is boring.
Okay, good.
That is fundamentally wrong.
No, omega is bigger than 40,000.
Bigger than 40,000.
Okay, that's not wrong. It's just it's very the effects are corrections.
I have a question for both you and for Lee.
Okay.
So, how would you feel if you replace the time evolution of the physical laws via phase transitions? So you imagine there's some underlying theory we don't know, and at different times, because I really like the time being absolute, you have different low energy manifestations. So time evolution being a series of phase transitions, evolution of the laws. How do you feel about that?
I mean, in a way, that's this infinity thing, right? You're trying to hide, you still have variability or not, depending on how you have this phase transition. In fact, the first thing we did was a phase transition, as you may remember, because we thought this way people wouldn't worry about what happens in detail, because it happens very fast. But that's kind of. But in fact, you don't really get rid of it. You basically, you just get the blip here, you get the delta function here, and you still have the same issues if it's a phase transition. So I think the issue is more one of whether there is time variability or not. Curiously enough, by the way, the thing which explains this is a phase transition. The phase transitions are something I love, but for other reasons. And I don't think it's kind of is the main issue here.
But now you're being swapped.
You know, I'm just changing sides. It's convenient, you know.
He is being radical, which means
go back to what it was.
Yeah, it's big. Life is a circle, right?
Next question from Stu.
I'd like to make a comment. Is this on?
No.
So I'd like to make a comment to both you and Lee and Roberto, if I may. Yesterday I was talking about the fact that biological evolution.
Yeah, it's on.
Shut up.
It's on.
Yesterday I was trying to talk about biological evolution and point out it is precisely an example of something that becomes in a non without Newtonian laws. There's no Newton-like laws, or there's no pre-statable phase space for the becoming of the biosphere. It's causal. as Roberto would want, but without laws. Clearly, the becoming of the biosphere is causal, leaving out quantum mechanics or putting it back in as you want. I'd like to suggest an idea that I've talked about to Lee sometime, and you might find congenial. Think of one universe, the singular universe, and instead of looking for a meta-law, which is going to get us into an infinite regress, give up, let there be variations in the laws and the constants, roughly however you want, then you might want to explore a selection criteria so that it's Darwin all the way down. And the Darwin all the way down, to make the comment this way, is the biosphere has become enormously diverse with nobody in charge. The economy has become enormously diverse with nobody in charge. They both become into the very possibilities that they create. That's just true. Mm-hmm. What if what's going on is that there are variations in the laws and the constants, however you want to do it, and there's a selection criteria using Lee's precedents so that we have a heritability. And what's going on is those laws that give rise to, and it'll make a prediction too in a moment, those laws and constants that give rise to a universe that becomes faster and more abundant and different, just wins. It's not that there's a competition, it just wins. Now this actually makes prediction. It's now climbing on some kind of fitness landscape of becoming. And what we know about climbing on landscapes is, if the laws change, most of the changes will happen early and then slow exponentially. This would then predict that whatever you're looking at changes, like the speed of light or whatever, but most of it happened in the very early universe and then it slows down. And gravitational waves might be able to see that because it can see back early, and so it might be possible to look at that.
I think that's interesting, indeed. Yeah.
Just a super quick comment to that, this evolution of universes. I think somebody actually wrote a theory where you have that the universes are selected for forming black holes because black holes form new universes.
That was Lee, wasn't it?
Oh, Lee.
That was Lee.
Then everybody knew that already.
No,
okay.
But the thing about the natural selection is not so much fitness to survival, but fitness to reproduce, right? Which is exactly the point.
What I'm saying is, instead of fitness to reproduce, it's just to become.
Right, right.
Become diverse. It's not reproducing. It's propagating.
I understand.
Why does the economy become diverse? It's just becoming.
That's very interesting.
Why isn't that sufficient? What more do we need?
I suppose we don't have a black hole mechanism to do that. We don't need it. That's true. That's true.
Also, Lee didn't really explain precedence in your presentation this time, which goes together with your idea. So we might want to ask him to talk a little bit about that in the panel. Not right now.
I think you...
So in the beginning, you said you wanted to let experiment sort of rule in the end. So which experiments are you thinking of for this stuff? And, you know, sort of what...
I was very...
Give us some sort of picture of what you're thinking.
So clearly, if you have... Well, this is... I also had a mea culpa at some point, which is saying this approach, in fact, if you're not careful, is ruled out by experiment immediately. Because if you have... You know, you do have this time variability within 6 months, right? Which is very serious. So you have to make sure you hide everything under the carpet of the early universe. We have like some exponential mechanism, which unfortunately creates this position that you're not testable, which is why I said I don't believe anything I say, because I do. I am working class. I am working class, and I rather pick these things which are less radical, not because I'm getting old and so on, but because I can actually predict this, you know, and I think that's more important. But I think for the sake of this, at least in principle, I could envisage an experiment, in principle, which should test this, which is...
Okay, Rafael has a question on the topic.
Yeah, it's a comment. You presented this as radical, and in some way dissed it as, I mean, disrespected it.
I also called it naive in the end, right?
Naive maybe, but I don't, in a certain sense, it's not radical at all, it's the opposite. Pardon me for saying, but in some sense it's reactionary because you want to go back. you want to go back to a notion of space-time that preceded the 20th century, and it wants to ignore
that's right.
The essential lessons about space-time that the 20th century has taught us.
So it's Newtonian.
Neo-Newtonian, as in neo-liberal. And I just want to say what I think the essential issue is, what the central lesson of the 20th century, it's not whether there's a distinguished frame or there's not a distinguished frame, it's the causal structure of space-time. It's the fact that we don't, you know, that causes operate within the light cone, and the causal order if you like, the temporal order of space-time is in the nature of a partial order and not a linear order,
but I think,
which is Newtonian. And sure, you're throwing that out. That's all I'm saying. Yeah. I mean, you can throw it out.
Well, but one thing I do. But one thing I'm doing,
I think
is,
we should.
But one thing I'm doing is making it more flexible, because I'm making the light cones less rigid. And in particular here, you might say, I like that so much, I make two copies of it. That's actually what biometric theory does. I like Lorentz invariant so much, I take two copies, I use one for gravity and one for matter. So I end up with a theory, the speed of light, which is different from the speed of gravity.
But then you still have a maximum speed, right?
Sorry?
Then you would
then
still
it's not radical. Then it's
still a maximum.
Well, on the other end, you explain this, so it's kind of, you can't win, right? You have to have one or the other, right? So.
Okay, we have two more on topic, and then...
Hi. I just wanted to question your perversity, your principle of no perversity there.
Yeah, you're Brazilian, right?
Yeah, so. That's where it caught my eye. Because many times we have fundamental laws that are not represented in solutions, right? I mean, you could have you have a spherical potential, but a solution might not be.
That's right.
And what justifies to call it perverse? It might be something that exists fundamentally, but is not represented in any particular solution.
No, I mean, it's the other way around. The solution has it. It doesn't need to be in the laws. So I say there's nothing deep here. It could be that way. And I did, the perversity thing was a joke, right? I don't mean, I mean, in a way, it's, but I did say that this in fact has dramatic observational implications, which rule this out immediately if you're not careful. It's very different way of, you know, there's nothing special about the preferred frame of the universe, right? A priori that doesn't need to break any invariants, diffeomorphism invariants, but gives you an opportunity to do so. That's all. If you want to, if you're so inclined, right?
Okay.
Sorry, Jao, I have a question. So you are saying, first of all, you are saying there's not possible to kind of violate conservation of energy with the Bohring scalar fields? That I get it correctly?
Well, you can, but if you have, that's the point. You can write a Lagrangian, which is time invariant, which determines the dynamics, and immediately, you could in principle. Also.
Yeah, I think because, you know, Hoyle-Nonnikov model was sort of like that. They introduce scalar field, which does that.
You then, can, you're right, yeah.
Yeah, so then the next question is whether you are violating this for a bit of time or it's going to be like their model, so you're going to keep producing matter later in the...
So that's exactly the point, why this is not very predictive, because you're free to design your C of T in any way you want. And of course you do it in a way which explains all these problems in the early universe, but then leaves you very little leverage to test the theory later on. But in fact, when we started working on this, there was this evidence for varying alpha. Mm-hmm. So we did become quite interested in ways of connecting these two things, because then it's something that happens in the last expansion time, redshift 1, redshift 2. So, yeah, it could be either way.
But so that may change the structure formation.
Yeah, but this theory is incredibly non-predictive in that sense, right? And I did say that immediately, and this is why I said I'm standing up here to defend something I don't believe in. But, yeah. Okay?
I guess my comment is for the panel. So, and Lee kept talking about laws and physical laws that should evolve with time, change with time, depending on how we study them. And this may just be a semantic point that I'm stuck on, but to me, the laws exist independent of us ever existing. Right? Do you mean that, independent of us writing them down, they exist? Right, okay. So to you, they should evolve regardless of our observation of us writing them. There are things that change?
Yes.
To make a better rule, like evolution? It's for evolutionary reasons?
I think we should really explore that in the panel discussion. I'm sharing it, and I feel there's really much more discussion that can happen on that.
We'll continue the discussion in the panel, and we'll proceed with law.
Okay, thank you. So
I'm here not as a specialist of time. I'm here as, you know, in some sense to play the roles that Lee wanted me to play, tried a bit of provocation, but also play along with the improvisation rule, that is change. I did change my talk according to what I've heard here. I want to, Lee and Marina, they asked me to think, or I provoked them into asking me to think about fundamental time. What I want to present in the spirit of Andy is not, you know, a results or a series of paper. It's just some questions I have about that. Maybe the puzzle is that, is there a notion of fundamental time? If there is, what it is? What is it? And I'm going to try to define it. It's clear that every speaker seems to have a different notion of what time is based on their experience, and maybe that's the status, that there's different time. The puzzle that I want to address is whether there's a notion of whether fundamental time exists, and if it exists, I want to argue that it has to be quantum, cannot be anything else than quantum. Although, you know, it can also, preparing this talk, I realize there's maybe another option, is gravitational. We'll see what I mean by that. Now, what I mean by, you know, the fundamental time, I think the discussion yesterday that Barbara started, and Stuart also, was very, very important, because it put the emphasis of what do we call fundamental physics. And as I see here, it's interesting that even people who are theoretical, I'm a theoretical physicist, so I'm, you know, I think in the sense that I believe that what we understand today is a tiny fraction of what we will understand tomorrow. In that view, maybe yesterday I was tagged with reduction as being a reductionist, so I have to take that. But I don't feel completely at ease with being called a reductionist, not just because it sounds very reductive, but I think because the nature of the problem of fundamental physics today has evolved. So let's say 50 years ago, a particle physicist, I think, you know, could be called a reductionist. But if today you're thinking about quantum gravity, I don't think it's fair to call us reductionists. Why am I saying that? I think there was something very important in both talks. They both mentioned, you know, that somehow there's different scales, and it's about and something that we have to discuss is the relationship between the part and the whole, right? And that somehow there's a dialogue between the two, and maybe there's new laws that appears, you know, at different time, and maybe, you know, I think a reductionist, if I understand properly, is somebody that believes that there's only the part and the whole emerge, and that's it, that it only goes one way, and you know. But if we think today what is fundamental physics, we have learned two things. We have learned both about what is the fundamental part and what is the whole. And this is why there's two types today of fundamental physicists, if you want. And the next revolution is to unify them. So what is the part for a theoretical physicist? It's particle physics. Okay, so it's essentially the theory about fundamental probes. Okay, and fundamental probes are, you know, quantum and relativistic. So they're quantum. Relativistic, that's going to be very important. Okay? And maybe, you know, unitary, let's say. Okay, so that's and you know, and if you're a particle physicist, you study fundamental probes. Now, and we understand this theory so well now that, in fact, you know, I'm thinking about the new revolution that's happening in the past few years about the rewriting of amplitudes, where we can resum tens of thousands of or hundreds of thousands of Feynman diagrams by having a new language to talk about how these amplitudes can be constructed. And we are still trying to understand what it is. So we understand it so well that from fundamental principle, we could almost build the standard model based on very simplistic principle. Now, the whole is the study of the whole universe. We have cosmologists here, and it's gravity, right? It's cosmology. And gravity, and the main discovery these days is gravity wave, which is one of the most amazing discovery ever made by humankind, I think. Now here, okay, and in between, maybe we have complexity, right? Where one law that rule time is. So now, what about time? Okay, so what is the problem of quantum gravity? The problem of quantum gravity, for me, is very simple. You have to be able to reconcile the part and the whole. You want to put the two together, which means that, for me, it means that I have to think about a revolution in physics where I can no longer think about scale being separated, and I have to find a way to somehow talk about the part and the whole as being something which works together as some oneness. That's the challenge. That's why it's hard, and that's why when we're going to understand it, it's going to be absolutely revolutionary, and maybe shed some light there, I don't know. The relationship with S dot equals zero is that not only we understand new things about particle, but we're understanding new things like these last few months or few years about gravity itself, especially when we take, or let's say in the past few years, what we have understood something special about gravity is that somehow in a gravitational system, there's no such things as a closed subsystem. So the history of physics has been, you know, based on the fact that you can separate systems and they're closed subsystems. In gravity, that's not possible. The reason it's not possible is called holography. It's the fact that if you take a region like that, gauge invariance tells you that somehow the energy, the bulk energy, is a constraint. And essentially, you have a generalization of the Gauss law that says that all energy projects itself on the boundary. That's the first thing. It's gauge invariance. Now, you know, gauge invariance is in electrodynamics. It's also true, but the property of gravity is that the charge associated with gravity, it's energy, which is positive, which means that you cannot have screening. Because you cannot have screening, you cannot shield what's happening inside the region from the boundary. And that's why gravity is fundamentally holographic. Okay, so in some sense, there's no way, another way to say it, there's no way to build up a Faraday box in gravity. There's no way to isolate a gravitational system, and that makes it very, very, very different than any other system. So we have to confront that. And people have speculated that maybe there's a relationship between S dot positive and gravity wave. Okay, but that's very conjectural. Now, what do I want to talk? So here we have seen lots of talk about that side, I think, time in that side, and I think the status is not clear. The previous talk was saying, well, there's a preferred frame, so there's a preferred time, right? Preferred time here. Or, in fact, in Carlo's talk, we saw that, or in Andy's talk, is that there's no clock, so no preferred clock. So there's too many times. Okay, so that's the status here. Now, the question I want to address when they asked me fundamental time, I was thinking, okay, what is the time associated with the part? Is it possible that fundamental objects, fundamental probes experience time or not? Like, if I'm trying to be a real reductionist, is time only a property that appears in emergence case, or there is something like that for fundamental probes? So, let me explain a problem which is very well known for relativists and physicists, but since a philosopher, I think it's useful to look at that. This is the problem of time for a fundamental probe, and essentially it's due to the presence of relativity. So the tension, for instance, with the talk is that there seems to be a preferred time for the whole, but there's clearly no preferred time for the parts. Okay, so that's somehow the tension we have to resolve. So relativity tells us that if you look at a free, so I'm going to take as a probe a free relativistic ensembles of particles first, you know, of particles. Okay, so what are their, you know, their action is a simple px dot, and then there's a constraint, which is the Hamiltonian constraints. Okay, so this is the action for a free-flying relativistic particle, which is here. Now, the main issue here is that this object here, let's say h of n, you know, has to vanish on shell. So it's a constraint system. Because it's a constraint system, the way we deal with constraint system is that we look at our phase space of our theory, we look at, you know, the subsets which satisfy these constraints, and then we look at the Hamiltonian flow it generates. And the Hamiltonian flow of the constraints is called gauge symmetry. Okay, but what is the Hamiltonian flow of the Hamiltonian? Well, it's motion. So relativity is confusing, because it says that motion is pure gauge. Okay? So now, you know, from a Newtonian point of view, if we think about motion as being the track of time, that's, this is somehow why fundamental physics has a problem to reconcile its, or let's say one of the reasons maybe. And this model is a kind of proxy for GR, but a simpler proxy. So motion is pure gauge, and if I try to compute the time elapse between two moments here, I'm going to have to integrate the lapse parameter. But the lapse parameter is the object that essentially generate gauge transformation. And in physics, we have this symmetry which is the reparametrization invariant, which is the one generated by H that says that delta X is epsilon P, and then delta epsilon N is d to epsilon. If we use this symmetry, we see that the time elapse between two moments can be changed at will. Okay, so that's the basic problem, is that motion is pure gauge, and time, proper time, is somehow a gauge parameter. So how do we resolve that? Well, there's two ways to resolve that. The first thing is that, of course, what I'm saying here is true for a free system. So the first resolution is that if there is no, I mean, we want to talk about time, and sometimes we say time is change. And some philosopher yesterday said that it's nice, but it's kind of a tautology, right? I'm changing a word for another one. It seems a better word for time, change, but I still have to define change. Right? And usually we define it in terms of time, so it's a bit of a... So here I want to define change, by interaction. So in order to have change, I have to have interactions between my subsystems, which are this relativistic particle. So I'm going to look at something a bit more interesting, which is, let's say, a bunch of particles, which are here, but that they are exchanging other particles, if you want. Okay, so if you want, and if you think about what's happening right now in the universe, this is really what's going on. There's billions and billions of particles which are emitted and absorbed all the time. So we have a process here, 3 minutes. Okay. So what I can do is model these subjects. So what is a relativistic process? A relativistic process is simple to parameterize. A process is a collection of edge and interaction vertices, and I can propose an action which is relativistic, which is a collection of relativistic action for each edges, plus an interaction term, and the interaction term is essentially telling me that I'm going to have conservation of momenta. So I sum over all edges that arrive at a vertex. And I add the Lagrange multiplier. So conservation of momenta, if you vary the action, leads to locality, the fact that it's telling you that interaction is happening at one point. And this is this point I want to be able to measure the time from. Now, if you work out the gauge symmetry of this system, you realize that there is two options. If the particle I'm using are really realistic particles, so let's say I'm using two massive particle that emit very soft photons, for instance, or that absorbs very soft photons, so that they stay on shell there. Then I can show that the gauge symmetry, which is a gauge symmetry for one object, still survives, is a gauge symmetry for the whole process. So if it's a gauge symmetry for the whole process, I cannot define the notion of proper time as an observable. In that case, what is the first option? The first option is, there's two options. One is to, option number one, let me describe option number one first. So suppose I look at this process and I want to define, what is the proper time in terms of observable, in terms of not assuming that space-time exists, but that space-time is the result of a complicated process like that. Then what are my options? And I said the only options you have in that case is really quantum mechanics. So classically, What I've described is classical. Classically, I cannot define proper time of relativistic interactions. Here I'm using that relativistic interactions are always contact interactions between fundamental probes. But quantum mechanically, I have an option. Why? Because if I look at why proper time is not observable, it's related to a very fundamental property of quantum mechanics, is that if I multiply, you know, a wave functions by a phase, the phase is completely irrelevant. So the reason proper time is not observable is because it's just the phase of the relativistic wave function. But of course, there's a way to observe the phase, and it's called interferences. So this, if I treat this phase as Aronoff-Bohm phases, then it becomes possible to observe them. So what I need to observe proper time is I need to look at superposition of the process one with two. If I have such a superposition, I can make an experiment that somehow determine the interference pattern there. And this is this interference pattern that will tell me what proper time elapsed is. So it's akin to this Aronoff-Bohm effect, that in the Aronoff-Bohm effect, classically, I cannot observe the gauge potential. But quantum mechanically, if I look at non-local observable, I can. And proper time is of the same nature. So in that sense, proper time is quantum. Now, the other, and that's where I can stop.
If there are no questions, then you can continue.
I think in the beginning when you when you're saying these things, I mean, you know, the discussion with the strong emergence and top down versus down up, bottom up approach. It seems to me that, and you're talking about quantum gravity, so it seems to me that here that it's a really different issue, right? I mean, namely, what we're talking about is really two theories, and there is a generality describes a world in one way, and quantum mechanics describes a world in another way, both conceptually and mathematically. And we don't have a unified way of describing the world, which is coherent and consistent, and then which goes in these limits to these two things. So from this perspective, it is very similar to, for example, what happened several times. I mean, in the 19th century, you know, there was electricity world and magnetism world, and they had to be united. Then in the beginning of the 20th century, there was special relativity, the Newtonian gravity world and special relativity world, and we wanted to unite, I mean, Einstein wanted to unite them. And and in this whole unification, if you look at the problem in this way, then this whole issue about strong emergence or top-down or bottom-up just doesn't, I mean, I don't see the relevance of this. And it's not that you are saying that the relevance of this, but I'm just adding another dimension here. It is not like the particle physics, you know, where one is, as you said the other day also, one is building up from either from elementary particles up to more complicated nuclei, etc. But if you look at the unification issue, then I just don't see what the issue is, right, here in terms of emergence. This is not really addressed just to you, but, you know, to the everybody here.
I don't know for sure. I know that the way you present it, this is the way I've thought about, you know, for many, many years, that it's really two theory. But that's not the way I think about it today. I think about it more elementary. I really think that one is about the UV, the other one is about the infrared, in the sense that, so, you know, that I'm not demanding that everybody accept this point of view, but I find it a very useful. In some sense, what I mean here is that gravity is about X, you know, what happens to space. And particle physics is about P, what happened to momentum and energy. And for me, reconciling these two is part of the quantum gravity program. I understand that this is a new take on the issue. And therefore, if you believe that, it's reconciling P with X, if you want. But that gives way to a completely new way to look at the problem of quantum gravity, which I don't know for sure. But then I see quantum gravity as a reconciliation of the UV with infrared, and I see the cosmological constant as the first type of observable which point us in the right direction, that somehow we have a tension between the two. But
the event that was repeatedly said in U2 about the LIGO event.
Yes.
That event is not anthropogenic.
No.
It is really, you know, the black holes are close to each other, they collide. And if anything, in general relativity, it is an ultraviolet.
I know, but it's a huge I mean, it's a pretty big object, maybe one of the biggest single object we have seen so far. I mean, it's a city size.
I want to, in a sense, pick up several things that have been said here. I got excited many years ago when Lee brought forward that idea of natural selection in cosmology. And I got excited about it because, precisely, it completely changed the paradigm. It wasn't the Newtonian paradigm. It was the paradigm of natural selection, the biology paradigm, applied to cosmology. And I think that was really very exciting because it was such a completely different view. Now, I wrote a review, which you read, in which I criticized some details of the thing, but nevertheless, I think as an idea, that is a really revolutionary idea in terms of a new paradigm as to how this relation between the laws and their implementation works.
So I have a question about that, and I'm sure it's something that I'm not understanding about what this is supposed to mean. So when Stuart talks about the evolution of the biosphere, I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to understand that as an example or as an analogy. So if it's an example, I mean, there's nothing in the evolution of the biosphere that is contrary to the laws of physics, right? So it's just that you need more information in that, you know, to understand exactly how the biosphere would develop, because there's just too much that is compatible with the laws of physics. So on the other hand, when Lee talks sometimes, it sounds to me like you mean it as an analogy. So this is partly a question about whether I'm understanding properly. If it's an analogy, then the suggestion would be that we are to understand what we now take to be the fundamental laws of physics as something like the laws that, you know, people who tried to write down the early history of the biosphere, not understanding that, you know, something quite different was going to happen later on.
Excuse me, let me just state the analogy, because it's a precise analogy to population dynamics, and Stu is somebody else, you can tell me if I get it wrong. In population biology, there is a space of genes, possible genotypes or phenotypes, if you prefer to organize them in terms of phenotypes.
It's working.
Sorry, in population biology, there is a space of genes or genotypes. In elementary particle physics, there is a space of parameters of the standard model. There is a fitness function in biology. Under certain assumptions, which I'll state, there is a fitness function in particle physics. Those assumptions are that black hole singularities bounce to form new universes, and that when that happens, the parameters undergo a small random deviation or fluctuation. So then, why is there a fitness function? Because the fitness function is a typical number of black holes to the future of such a singularity as a function of the parameters. It's not hard to do some astrophysics and find out that fitness function is full of peaks and valleys. There are values of the parameters for which there would be very few black holes as far as we can tell. We live in a universe where there are many of at least 10 to the 18. And it's possible to argue that that's near a maximum. So that's the analogy, and it leads to certain implications and certain predictions, which I can talk about in the panel discussion.
Just a small question. So this goes back to the meta law that you were describing, because if you say that universes evolve from one another, then these are space-time that evolve from one another, but then don't you need a higher something higher, more general than space-time, for different space-time to evolve from one another. Isn't that the meta law, or can you escape that? But within what does it happen? It does not happen within our space-time, but within something larger, within... So it's the same space-time? Okay, thank you.
There it is. A little bit more about the fitness landscape, which is something I have not understood
about cosmological natural selection, and I'm wondering if it's a place to sort of to find a richer set of phenomena. What I see is differential reproducibility. Some universes give rise to more black holes than others, and you expect them to proliferate. What I've never seen in it is any sense of niche creation, any sense of a dynamical environment in which the black holes are reproducing. That would be the full analogy with natural selection. So there's no absolute...
it's an analogy to population biology in its pure formal sense that I said. There is not an environment, there's no sex, there's no niches, there's no competition.
Well, then what is the sense of... it seems to me you could get a richer... this is the source of novelty in biology, in evolution. And it seems to me that if you built in some sense of environment, you might actually be able to generate novelty in a way that I'm not sure you can in what you have right now.
Universes discover that they, by forming carbon monoxide, by having stable carbon and stable oxygen, they have very efficient cooling and therefore can make very massive stars plentifully and therefore can make black holes in a way that they couldn't before there was carbon and oxygen.
This is not a question for Laurent. Should I wait for the panel?
You're good.
Sorry?
You're going to make a short point about this, right?
No, it's a response to Lee and Roberto. Do you want it now or do you want it after?
You can give it
now?
Panel? No.
Okay, so I think if you wanted provocation, Francesca calling Roberto a reactionary was a good example of provocation. I mean, attacking Roberto from the left is not easy. So the question is what is going to happen? What is happening here? And Roberto and Lee gave us a story. In fact, wrote a big book, which I read, to which Francesca was answering, to which many people here have been answering. So I want to shortly try to give this answer, especially because Roberto synthesized Lee's story in 3 points. Okay. So if you want to know the 3 points, wait, have a good coffee and then I'll tell you.